I'm Ashok Modi. I now teach at Princeton University's School of Public and International Affairs. Previously have spent a career at the World Bank and IMF.
Thank you very much indeed for speaking today. We're sitting in St. John's College in Cambridge as we speak. The UK's mini budget that caused such turbulence is now being mostly reversed by the UK's new Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt. But if we row back, the talk in the British economy was all about Brexit. And indeed, some commentators, distinguished commentators on the right and the left, are attributing the UK's present crisis not just to the Liz Truss mini budget, but also to Brexit. So I have to begin by asking you, Professor Modi, how do you think Brexit has gone?
So let me just first, I have to comment on the recent turbulence. Quite honestly, I think it was madness. The idea of a tax cut as having any meaningful impact on the economy, especially the idea that a tax cut will raise the growth rate, is to put it simply, only madness. There is no evidence. There never has been any evidence. For the last 40 years, people have tortured the data and it is not yet confessed. So the idea that a tax cut will do anything good for the economy except make the rich richer is nonsense. The fact that the markets then responded adversely, unlike in the past where the rich have been quite happy to accept that generosity of the government, was a surprise. And it was a surprise only because it was done in such a shoddy manner. And the following turbulence was also then a natural follow-up, again, of a set of policies that have been put in place, which is the vast amount of liquidity that has been injected into the economy. And the one thing policymakers have not yet figured out, that while they are quick to inject liquidity, private actors take that liquidity and make long-term commitments. Liquidity is supposed to be a short-term instrument, but private actors believe, and it turns out rightly, that the government is not going to withdraw that liquidity. And so they were surprised that the liquidity was being withdrawn, and that was the other source of turbulence. In other words, the turbulence that Britain experienced is a commentary on the misguided policies that the Western world has been following for a very long time. And it came to a crystallization in that moment. So that's the cause of the current turbulence. This has nothing to do with Brexit.
No, commentators, as I said, on the right and left have been attributing it to Brexit, saying it didn't leave the Truss government with much room for manoeuvre.
I don't believe so. If there was a promise at the time of Brexit, and I believe that Theresa May's first Conservative Party conference did make that promise, it was to help those who needed help. Now, maybe I'm putting words in her mouth, but there was a certain sense that a post-Brexit Britain would be a fairer Britain. The areas that were left out of the development process over the last many years as Britain deindustrialized would get a leg up.
Leveling up.
Is that the phrase, leveling up? Yes. And my main regret here is that that never happened, or did not happen on the scale that was necessary. That said, while I am happy to acknowledge this failure, the idea that Brexit has been the source, either now or in any medium run sense since 2016, has been a source of Britain's economic ills, is simply not there in the data. So I've been hearing since I've come to Britain a statistic that before Brexit, the British economy was 90% the size of Germany, and that today it is 70% the size of Germany. That, quite honestly, is complete bullshit. I was astonished when I heard it, and I said, that cannot be true.
It's doing the rounds on Twitter.
Well, I'm not surprised. It's a very attractive statistic to peddle. So if that had happened, we would have seen complete chaos. We would have seen the ending of civilization. So I looked up the numbers, and here's what I found, to my surprise. I was not expecting this. But if I looked at the IMF's data, if anything, and I stress if anything, the British economy has performed slightly better than the German economy since Brexit. In so many dimensions. GDP growth in Britain has been slightly higher than German GDP growth. Export-import growth has been on par. If I look at the per capita incomes in Germany and Britain, Britain was a poorer country than Germany. British GDP per capita was about 80% of German GDP per capita in 2015. It is now slightly more than 80%. In fact, if I'm saying this very cautiously because I don't want to make an overstatement, but if I understand the IMF statistics, the British GDP per capita is now about 85% of German. So it's gone in the direction of making Britain slightly richer relative to Germany than poorer. Let's stipulate that that's not a correct statement, but there's certainly no basis from any argument that Britain has become poorer relative to Germany. And let's also acknowledge here that Germany is the best performing Eurozone country. So if Britain has done at least as well, if not slightly better than Germany, then it's not clear to me what is sort of the catastrophic harm that has occurred. I looked up one final statistic, and this is on patents. So I looked up the patents awarded in the German patent office to German nationals. Germans always patented more than the Brits did. But German patents have been flat since 2015, annual patents have not increased. Again, the astonishing thing is, and I don't know if this is some special thing that's happening which I'm not aware of, but the patents awarded, granted to British nationals in the British Patent Office have gone up. So again, we don't see any relative change in favor of Germany. If anything, they are in favor of Britain.
If we now, and thank you for that, that will certainly be insightful to many people in the UK at the moment, but is the present turbulence pushing the euro into possibly an uncontrollable area? How stable do you think the euro is?
Look, again, we must differentiate between what's happening now and what is happening in the longer term. Just as I said for Britain, of course, in Britain there has been this unusually mindless tax cut policy that has triggered turbulence. But let's stipulate, I think this is a correct statement, that the world is going through a period of extraordinary turbulence. We had the COVID crisis first, we have the Ukraine crisis, The combination of the two has led to inflationary pressures. Those inflationary pressures have caused central banks to raise interest rates. So much has been condensed in such a short time. Therefore, there is turbulence everywhere, and there's no question in my mind that that turbulence will continue, at least for the next couple of years, if not for 4 or 5 years. So there's turbulence everywhere. As part of that turbulence, the value of the euro relative to the US dollar has declined. But the value of virtually every currency in the world has declined relative to the US dollar. There are deep historical reasons why the dollar strengthens at points of turbulence and everyone else weakens. The only thing I can say on this is that the European sense of arrogance that somehow the euro will compete with the US dollar has not happened, and the best I can predict today will not happen. But the weakness of the euro, even though it signifies that the euro will not be a substitute for the dollar, is not necessarily a weakness of the eurozone. It's a global phenomenon happening everywhere. The eurozone has long-term structural problems. But the weakness of the euro is not symptomatic of those structural problems. What is true is that out of this turbulence that I just described, the COVID, Ukraine crisis, the rising interest rates, and especially for Germany, the energy shock, those combined, in my reading of the trends, is aggravating some of the euro's longer-term structural problems. And specifically, it is doing two things, one to Germany and one to Italy. Sometime starting in 2015 or 16, I began to feel, especially after the Volkswagen crisis in which the company was accused of fudging its pollution control results, that the German industrial model, which had been a hardy perennial in Europe, and which had given Germans decades of prosperity, that model was beginning to waver. And we saw that in the emergence of electric cars, and we saw that in the emergence of a new range of information technologies. And for some reasons, Germany was lagging in those new endeavors. The energy shock has greatly amplified that pre-existing fragility of the German industrial growth model. Germans are extremely innovative, and they have reinvented their economy in the past. So I'm not saying that they will not do so again. But at least now, the best we know in say, the next 3 to 7 year time frame, the German economy is going to have to go through a painful transition in which it will have to reorient itself. In that painful transition, traditional German balance of payment surpluses, where they exported more and imported ever more and imported less from the world economy, that is already beginning to disappear. There will be greater tightness in the German fiscal budget. So Germany's role as the motor economy of the European Union and the Eurozone in particular is in doubt. That's the first structural change that is of crucial importance for the long-term health of the Eurozone. And the second is nothing new, that the fault line of the euro always ran through Italy. And that fault line was smothered in the post-COVID period through extraordinary ECB liquidity. So, in effect, for the last 3 years, the European Central Bank has been financing the Italian government. And various eyebrows have been raised for a long time, and people have tried to look the other way, pretending that that was not happening. But now that the European Central Bank has to withdraw that liquidity, they say they will do it slower than the US Federal Reserve is doing, but they have to withdraw that liquidity in any case. Just as the withdrawal of liquidity exposed the fragility of pension funds in the UK, the withdrawal of liquidity in the Eurozone is going to again put in glare the Italian government's financial fragility.
Yes, because if we actually look, if I may intervene here, Professor Modi, if we may look at what's happening in the UK, that people talk about contagion, that, you know, there was a fear before Jeremy Hunt just a few hours ago steadied the economy with his announcements of mini-budget reversals and possibly public sector cuts too. But it was said that the UK would cause the contagion. But what you're saying is the European economies, as well as the UK economy, are unsteady because of COVID, because of Ukraine, because of pouring in liquidity into the systems. And if that's true, then are there actions, and maybe actions in common, that the UK and European economies can take to steady the ship?
Okay. It's a very important question. Let me get to that, but let me just complete the Eurozone story briefly. With Germany weakening and the Italian fragility exposing itself again, the Eurozone stands at a very crucial juncture. The problem with the Eurozone always was, the sort of the original sin of the euro was, to impose a single currency on vastly different countries. And the premise was that the Germans, in a crisis, would quote-unquote always do the right thing, which is help bail out the weaker countries. We are reaching the point where the weaker countries are weaker than before, and the German ability and willingness to bail out the weak countries is going to become less forthcoming because of Germany's own internal problems becoming more acute. Therefore, to come back to your question of what we can do to deal with the current turbulence, it's not completely clear to me whether in the Eurozone or in the UK or in America where I live, that there is very much we can do to calm the turbulence. Yes, short-term policies are going to help. I have not yet seen the reaction to Jeremy Hunt's policies, but let's stipulate that they have a short-term calming effect. But the more medium-term problems that we have talked about, the Ukraine crisis, the energy crisis, the inflation rates, the withdrawal of liquidity, all of these in combination are going to continue the turbulence in one form or another for a while. I don't think there is any escape from that. Therefore, at this point in time, my only hope is that while dealing with the short term as best as we can, we begin to think of the next phase. The next phase is also with us. The climate crisis is with us. This idea that there will be a climate crisis if global temperatures exceed 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels, that's no longer an acceptable idea. We know that at 1.1 degree, which is where we are today, there have been heat waves and floods and cyclones and typhoons, sea levels rising. And I think the world has to pay vastly more attention to the climate crisis than it did at COP26 in Glasgow last year. I don't see any willingness to do that. That transition to dealing with the climate crisis is both a challenge and an opportunity. I believe that if we look through the current turbulence, by look through I mean manage it as best as we can, but prepare for the next round in a way that is inclusive, that brings in everyone into the picture, that creates a better world for ourselves. That is where we need to be going. And that is why I think that preparing for that today is the most important economic challenge that we have.
But that is a longer term view.
Yes.
That we're going to go through, whether we're in the UK or Europe, and possibly America too, this very bumpy, up and down few years ahead. But how bumpy is it going to be? And will the monetary or fiscal policies of Europe or the UK provide a solution in the shorter and medium terms? Or are we just going to have to hold tight?
I think I'll begin by reflecting on your last phrase. I think we will have to hold tight. I am not sure that we know how bumpy it will be. In a way, when we use the expression bumpy, we almost mean that we cannot predict how bumpy it will be.
A Great Depression like the 1930s?
A Great Depression, I think, will not happen. You notice I've been very careful, because at this point in time, small mistakes can lead to large consequences. Therefore, we cannot unfortunately rule out anything, but let us say that it's very unlikely. There is a certain technological momentum ongoing in the world economy. That's crucial, because that's what's going to take us out. But I would say that it will be bumpy. People will feel the pain in the form of high inflation for a while, in terms of employment prospects being insecure. I think that's the kind of bumpiness. And a general sense of anxiety will prevail everywhere. Therefore, the current will have to be dealt with more or less by ad hoc measures. I'm hoping that this central bank policy of dealing with every crisis through injections of liquidity will not continue. In other words, it might actually help reduce the next bump that we encounter. But that only seems to build up costs for the future. Therefore, in some sense, I would almost prefer that we deal with the bumpiness instead of trying to smooth it out.
So higher energy, higher mortgage costs.
Exactly. I think we have lived in a sort of fool's world for a while, where we thought we could have everything that we wanted. I think the time has come to face up to the fact that that is not going to happen and that we need to adjust. And this is the long-term adjustment on all of these fronts, housing, energy, climate. It is these adjustments that I think we are going to have to deal with.
Thank you for that rather insightful explanation of the problems our economies are facing, both in the UK and in Europe and America. But you're here, Professor Modi, to deliver a paper, Economics Through a Moral Lens. Now, in what way should we view economic policies through a moral lens? Are we talking about more funding for education, more funding for health, thinking more in terms of the public good rather than, should I phrase it, as private or corporate greed?
I think that's a good phrasing. In my lecture, I go back to the notion that economists believe that human beings act mainly or entirely from selfishness. And so therefore I've been struck by reading Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he says that human beings have an innate sympathy, that they care about each other, that they think it is right to be fair, that there are loyalties, that there is sanctity, that these are part of who we are. Modern psychologists, 300 years after Adam Smith, validate that psychological interpretation of human beings. So in some sense, in the terminology of today, Adam Smith was the first behavioral economist the world knew. That's the idea. What follows then is that because those sympathies can be hijacked by what Adam Smith calls passions, it is necessary to construct social norms that restrain those passions. That's the abstract idea. How does this translate into practice? Greater trust, greater cooperation, and trust and cooperation then towards what you have called public goods. Much more investment in education, in health, in repairing cities, in repairing the environment. And interestingly, Adam Smith, in his Wealth of Nations, that is regarded as the Bible of free marketeers, talks about the justice system. The justice system is where everything comes together. If the justice system doesn't work, then nothing works. Now, in the country where I live, the United States, and my country of origin, India, that is where I believe that the justice system is faltering in the U.S. and maybe in an acute existential crisis in India. So the implication is that we have ignored for almost half a century the delivery of public goods. Why is that important? Because that is where the notion of fairness, of equality, of inclusiveness comes in. These tend to be slogans, but these make real impact on the lived reality of people.
Social cohesion.
And therefore on social cohesion. Exactly. And therefore on social cohesion. And that is what is missing. The Reagan-Thatcher policies of the last half century or thereabouts have encouraged this notion, which we have just seen play out, that tax cuts are a good idea. Now, not only are tax cuts a bad idea, just by the limited, narrow vision of mainstream economics, tax cuts are a bad idea for a larger reason. They break the social cohesion. How? They foster inequality, the rich become richer, real wages of the ordinary people stagnate. There is a tendency to make policies by slogans and headline grabbing rather than what is it going to do for people. My focus, both in my lecture and in a book that is forthcoming that I've done on post-independence India.
India is broken.
India is broken. Is exactly on this theme that we do not focus the policy on the lives and livelihoods of people. We focus policies on some abstract notions which grab headlines and which seem the grown-up thing to do, but do not filter into people's lives. A moral economy is both fundamentally possible, is the right thing, and it is what is desperately needed. We talked earlier in this conversation about what is the longer vision. And I spoke about the climate crisis. The climate crisis is in some sense the deepest symbol of our moral failure. A climate crisis says, I don't care about you. My behavior is, if I hurt you, if I damage your livelihoods, or if I damage your environment, c'est la vie. I certainly don't care about future generations. It's this notion that I care about and have sympathy for you, for my children, for your children, and for grandchildren. That, to me, is a moral economy. And it is fundamental if we are going to survive as good human beings living in a decent society. Otherwise, at this current juncture, what I fear much more than the turbulence that we are seeing is that we, and this is true worldwide, this is why I brought up India into this conversation, which was not the main theme of our conversation, is that there is a fraying, a
centralization of power.
A centralization of power, exactly. A centralization of power that distances itself from people. And we need to have a recreation. I'm not suggesting we go back to village life in some kind of old romantic way, but we need to give greater importance to the local level governance process where people feel that they have a say in what's happening, at least in their immediate surroundings. They can hold their politicians more accountable. And that then creates a foundation within which people act, learn to act with trust and cooperation, where people don't live with the presumption that you are going to act in bad faith, that there is some notion that I can have this, some confidence that you're not going to cheat me. It is that sense which I feel is pervasive today, and that is what I mean by recreating a moral economy.
And as I said, your paper looks at Europe, the USA, and India. Yes. You're very critical of India, aren't you?
Yes. I'm critical of India. This is a very odd moment, because I don't know if you saw the London Economist had a cover story, "This is India's Moment." So my wife will often tell friends that I'm completely predictable, that when I need to turn left, I turn right. And so you can know exactly what to do and what not to do by my actions, even though I might be going wrong. The Economist is a lot like that. The Economist's predictions are often 180 degrees the opposite of what is reality. In I think in December 1971, when Mrs. Gandhi helped engineer to help stop the genocide that was happening in what is now known as Bangladesh, and thereby helped engineer the breakup of Pakistan and into Pakistan and Bangladesh, The Economist had a cover story which called her the Empress and described her as the Empress not just of India but perhaps of all of South Asia. And this was a moment in which Mrs. Gandhi was acquiring steadily greater authoritarian power well before the dictatorial emergency she adopted in 1975. The Economist had a cover story on Ireland with the title, I think, Poor Ireland, where they showed a beggar woman with a child in her arms on a street in Dublin. It was so demeaning of Ireland at just the moment when the Celtic tiger was emerging, was about to roar. So they're liable to get their prognostications exactly wrong. In the case of the India story, remember India is a country of 1.4 billion people. There are probably 100 million people who live first world lives, perhaps better, because they have much cheaper personal services like chauffeurs and maids and so on, which no one in the West can afford anymore. But there are probably a billion people living a much more difficult life. And my reading, again, the data on this is very clear. Indian health delivery systems are very poor. India spends perhaps the lowest amount of per capita on health expenditure in any group of major international countries. If anything, health spending in real terms has gone down. Indian education. Again, there is a tendency to think of Silicon Valley chief executives as a symbol of Indian education. But the quality of Indian education is so pathetically poor. My mother used to tutor a girl who was in middle school. And now she's gone into a government-run high school in Delhi. She tells me there are 90 students in her class. Sometimes there is not enough space for everyone to have a seat. They stand or they sit on the floor. This is in New Delhi. And I asked her, what do you do in class? She says, well, I do my other things because I have no idea what the teacher is saying. 30% of Indian students drop out at the secondary level. And then those who do graduate go to these garbage colleges. So health, education, the environment is in a completely sorry state. The rivers are drying, they are polluted, groundwater depletion is occurring all over the country. Where the groundwater is not completely depleted, it's also getting polluted. The cities are in shambles, and the justice system, as I said to you, is crumbling. Just one indicator I'll give you of the justice system, which breaks my heart. There is a tendency in India to arrest people for reasons that are not completely clear. And then they get clogged up in the justice system because they are not tried for years. They're arrested but not tried. They're called the under trials. One statistic tells me that 75% of India's prison population are under trials. They are there waiting for a trial. And many of them have served longer sentences waiting than the sentences they would receive if they were proven to have committed the crime that they are alleged to have committed. And then once in prison, they are tortured to extract false confessions. There's a lot more happening in the justice system, but this in some sense is the most gruesome of them all.
When is your book due to come out? I think it's called India is Broken, as we said earlier, but do you think we need to dig deeper as the West reporting on India? And then this also leads me on to my final question, because I know you've talked about short and medium term turbulence, but the Biden administration in the USA, you think is doing the right thing in terms of trying to focus its policies, its new policies on climate change?
Look, today, if there is any world leader who I look up to, and I say this cautiously because I did not always do so, it is Joe Biden. There's one phrase Joe Biden uses often, which really talks to me. He will say, and I just heard him say this maybe 2 or 3 days ago. He says, "I always remember my father. He used to say that people should have room to breathe." He said, when we sat down at the end of the month at the kitchen table, he would say, "We have paid our bills and we have a little left over." And I believe that Biden truly believes in that sentiment. And I've used abstract phrases like lived reality and lives and livelihoods. That's what it ultimately boils down to. He's dealing with an enormously difficult political problem with the Republican opposition in the US Congress. And he's dealing with enormous turbulence that we've talked about so extensively today. That said, the measures he has been able to pass, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, try to bring down healthcare costs. They try to bring down the costs of energy. They are investing in the future in terms of new technologies. They are putting money into climate research, climate investments, repairing bridges, trying to deal with student loan forgiveness. America is coming to this point after decades in which that morality has gone. To see that somebody openly espouses that morality and within the severe constraints within which he operates, he nevertheless tries to find legislative ways forward, I think is admirable. I think, you know, I have no idea what's going to happen in the midterm elections that are ongoing as we speak. The early voting has already started. But if Biden fails because the politics does not allow him to go forward, I think the world would have lost a moral leader. And it's not clear to me that we have any substitute globally at this point in time for somebody like him. Therefore, to use an American expression, I'm putting my money on Biden at this point.
And that's where our optimism lies, in something looking, policymakers looking to the longer term and particularly looking at climate change and showing empathy and sympathy, yes, in the global north about what's happening in the global south. Professor Ashok Modi, I feel very privileged to sit here talking about your views on the world economies and also having read your paper on the economics through a moral lens. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure.